It's wonderful, as always, to see your faces, to be able to sit with you. In this week's Torah reading, Parshat Truma, we listen in on God's instructions to Moses on how to create space for the ineffable, the infinite, the unknowable in this material world. And especially within each of us. So, how do we create space for the ineffable in this material world, for ourselves and for the community to experience together? It's not an easy task. No wonder it takes five Torah readings to describe it. In contrast, the description of God creating the whole world in Bereshit is described in a mere 31 lines at the beginning of the first Torah reading. It seems as if it was a much more streamlined process for God to create the whole world than for the Israelites to create a space for Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh in that world. And if we think about it, this makes sense. It's not easy to make space in the material world for something that we cannot see or touch. But something that seems to be an essential part of our civilization and perhaps essential for our well-being. It's not a simple matter to get a stubborn, contentious group of people to collaborate and contribute to building something together. The Israelites who had been in Egypt had been driven by taskmasters to build things. How could their traumatic associations to building get reprogrammed so that they could build something that they felt personally invested in, so that they could contribute freely and willingly? This would take a lot of planning on the part of God and Moses. In order to put this project in context, let's reflect on how we got to this dramatic moment in our relationship with God, in this story of our relationship with God, for we can read Torah as just that, the story of our longings, our struggles, our gratifications and disappointments, in our relationship with the presence that we can imagine but can't describe. Because we're reflecting on the path that leads up to the building of the Mishkan, which is the movable sanctuary that the Israelites will carry with them through the wilderness, I'll make note of the points in this story that describe construction projects and structures that represent a relationship in one way or another with Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. In the beginning, we imagine God as a creator constructing a world for us. An earth that will nurture and support the earthling, Adam, plants and animals, and a companion. And when these humans test the limits that God has set for them, they have to leave the Garden of Eden. They're expelled from the home in which God offered perfect nurturance. Yet they stay in relationship with God, and indeed their children, Cain and Abel, for them, pleasing this God with their offerings is literally a matter of life and death. Yet humankind proves to be disappointing to God, for Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh saw in Noah's generation how great was God's evil doing on earth. God decided to blot out humankind, saying, "For I am sorry that I made them." But Noah found favor in the eyes of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. So God gives Noah very specific measurements for the ark, 300 by 50 by 30 cubits, three decks, a skylight. And as the generations after Noah unfold, humans embark on a fantastic building project, the Tower of Babel. In contrast to the very specific limits and measures that God gives for building the ark and later for the Mishkan, The Tower of Babel has no limits, no measurements. The people intended the Tower of Babel as a protection against being scattered over the face of the earth, perhaps a response to the generational trauma of being ejected from the Garden of Eden. "Come now," they said, "let us build ourselves a city and a tower, its top in the heavens, and let us make ourselves a name, lest we be scattered over the face of all the earth." But God came down to look over the city and the tower that the humans were building and said, "Here, they are one people with one language for them all, and this is merely the first of their doings. Now there will be no barrier for them in all that they scheme to do. Let us go down, and there let us baffle their language so that no man will understand the language of his neighbor." So a theme is emerging here that God cannot trust humans with their building projects. God needs to give precise measurements and limits lest humans try to create something that competes with God. Some 10 generations later, we read about a different, more enduring relationship that develops between God and Abraham. The relationship begins with God instructing Abraham to leave his birthplace and his father's house, to go to a land that I will show you. God reassures Abraham at different moments in the story that Abraham will be the father of a great nation. One moment of communication takes place at the entrance of Abraham and Sarah's tent when the three messengers visit. This tent is another structure that becomes a symbol with many meanings. It's a symbol of hospitality and nurturance, generosity. It's like a tent of meeting, a foreshadowing of the structure where God will consult with Moses in the book of Exodus. And Sarah's tent is the place where Isaac, grieving the loss of his mother, takes Rebekah when she arrives to become his wife. Isaac and Rebekah's children, Jacob and Esau, both leave the home of their parents. And the night that Jacob leaves home, he picks a stone to rest his head on and has a dream of a stairway to heaven and a vision of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And when he awakens, he says, "Surely Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is present in this place, and I did not know it. This is none other than the abode of God, and that is the gateway to heaven." He sets the stone on which he rested his head as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. And he named that site Bethel, the house of God. So Jacob recognizes that this ineffable presence is not just up in heaven at the top of a ladder, but is in this place right here on earth, where we are, and which we can recognize only when we are in a state of readiness to become aware of it. So when we finally get to the point in the story that we read this week in Parshat Truma, "Let them build me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them," we might say, well, hasn't Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh been present, dwelling here all along, and we did not know it? So what is the process that the Israelites have to go through in order to know it, become aware of it? They do go through a process of displacement, exile, servitude, liberation, and revelation before they can, as a community, experience God in their midst and within each of them, as the story goes. Jacob and all his offspring have to follow Joseph down to Egypt in order to experience the constrictions of servitude and then the liberation brought about by the great miracles that took place in Egypt. After liberation, as they traveled through the wilderness, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh went before them in a pillar of cloud by day to guide them along the way, and a pillar of fire by night to give them light, that they might travel day and night. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people. Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is a visible presence here, a guiding force they can see. And this representation of God as a visible, kind of external guiding force is about to evolve into a new type of experience of connection with the ineffable. For upon encampment at Sinai, the Israelites will need to prepare for a momentous event, a moment when this presence of God, when it reveals God's self. Again, we might wonder, hasn't God been there all along, a helping hand, a guide, a rescuer, a liberator? But this God is working miracles in the world for the Israelites, around the Israelites, and has not yet, it seems, changed the inner experience, the emotional, spiritual, and mental life of the Israelites. How can God make a difference in how the people see themselves, their roles on earth? How can they respond compassionately to others, becoming the hands that offer the compassionate help for which God serves as an example? Well, God could reveal this plan at Mount Sinai. And so all the people witnessed the thunder and lightning, the blare of the horn and the smoking mountain. And when the people saw it, they fell back and stood at a distance. They send Moses to bear witness for them, for this is not a presence that they can experience directly. Yet they do trust Moses to bring God's message back to them, which Moses does. However, in this awesome process of revelation, all senses and all accounting for time and the order of events are confused. We can interpret the unfolding of the story in different ways, as it has been interpreted by different commentators. If we interpret the chronology of the story as we read it in the order of the different Torah, of the Torah readings, it seems that the revelation took place and then Moses received instructions for building the Mishkan. This reading of the story suggests that the people were left with the dilemma, how do we represent what we experienced at Sinai? How do we create a space for the inexpressible within this material world? And when Aviva Zornberg discusses this, she reminds us that all of art is, in some way, containing the inexpressible, what cannot be spelled out in words, music, art, literature, all creative processes like that. Zornberg points out that the task of building the Mishkan requires working together with other people, but it's also a joint project with Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, that people need to be able to receive instructions and understand and implement the plan. Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh cannot make a home for God's self on earth. This has to be a joint project with God. Ve'asuli mikdash, build me a sanctuary, v'shachanti b'toham, that I may dwell among them. This reading describes God's desire to be invited, to be given a home within the midst of the people, rather than outside, a force that passes over, rescues, works miracles, rather than just outside. This is an empty space into which people can invite God's presence and in which they can have an encounter with God, a relationship with God, in which God can be revealed in whatever way might emerge. Unlike a statue or perhaps a solid golden calf, the sanctuary is an empty space in which encounter with the ineffable can happen. It's not a solid object to be worshipped, not a statue that would objectify God or make God a thing. There is another reading of the phrase Vishahanti Bitoham, beyond that I may dwell among them, rather within each that I may dwell within them, within each of them. But what has to happen to make it possible for God to dwell within a human? Surely there has to be a preparatory process, which brings us to a different interpretation of the chronology of the events in this second half of Exodus. According to Maimonides' commentary, as explained by Aviva Zornberg, we can understand that the plans for building the Mishkan and perhaps even the whole revelation may be occurring after the golden calf episode. If we imagine Moses going up the mountain to receive the instructions, leaving the people behind, they become terrified, beg for something to worship, we would understand the golden calf incident as preceding the instructions for the Mishkan. And according to this version, there is a 120-day countdown from Shavuot to Yom Kippur, which recapitulates the process in which the people atone for the golden calf. They're rehabilitated from their impulsive actions of building the golden calf. It gives them time to learn and follow the mitzvot, repent, transform themselves into a proper dwelling place for Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, so that they're finally ready for Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh to dwell among them by Yom Kippur, a day on which their repentance is complete. Well, whichever chronology you choose, we see a pattern of contrast between something solid, the golden calf, and something open, the sanctuary. Something built in haste, out of a great sense of need, out of fear and longing that drives reckless action, versus something built with care and planning, following rules, with collaboration. The Tower of Babel and the Golden Calf were born out of fear and dread. In contrast, Truma begins with an invitation to act out of generosity. Tell the Israelite people to bring me gifts. You shall accept gifts from me, from every person whose heart is so moved. And indeed, they were moved to bring even more gold and silver and fabric and gems than were needed. So, as Yocheved often says, Torah gives us instructions for meditation practice. And we can read the instructions for the Mishkan in just that way. Each time we sit, we carefully create structure using the body, the somatic experience, as the scaffolding and material that both contains and shapes our practice. Within that carefully constructed form is, of course, the emptiness in which we encounter whatever is arising at each moment, our own encounter with the ineffable that dwells within us.